North Korea is the impossible state. It's a place that stumped leaders and policymakers for more than three decades. It has a complex history, and it has become the United States' top national security priority. Each week on this show, we'll talk with the people who know the most about North Korea.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Impossible State podcast. My name is Victor Cha, Senior Vice President for Asia and Korea Chair at CSIS, Professor at Georgetown University. I hope everybody, at least who is in the United States watching our show, had a good Thanksgiving as we move into the holiday season. Today, we're going to be spending a little bit of time talking about Japan with one of Washington, D.C.'s top think tank experts on Japan and a good friend, Yuki Tatsumi. So Yuki, it's great to have you with us today. Let me properly introduce you to our audience before
Thanks,
we
Victor.
Get started. So Yuki Tatsumi is a senior fellow and co-director of the East Asia Program and director of the Japan Program at the Stimson Center here in Washington, D.C. Before joining Stimson, she worked as a research associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, so an alum of CSIS, and as the Special Assistant for Political Affairs at the Embassy of Japan in Washington, D.C. She is an accomplished author with many publications. I cannot go through the entire list here, so I won't even try. I'm sure you can find it on her bio on her website. But I would like to say that she has testified before the House Committee on International Relations, and she's the recipient of the 2009 Yasuhiro Nakasone Incentive Award. In 2012, she was awarded the Letter of Appreciation from the Ministry of National Policy of Japan for her contribution to advancing mutual understanding between the United States and Japan. She's a native of Tokyo, holds a BA in liberal arts from International Christian University in Tokyo, and an MA in International Economics and Asian Studies from Georgetown. No, it's not Georgetown.
No.
It's the
other one.
School of Advanced International Studies, SAIS, at Johns Hopkins University in Washington, D.C. Well, everybody can't have a perfect bio, so. But it's great. Yuki, thanks so much for joining us. I hope you had good holidays.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, great.
I did.
That's
thanks for
terrific.
Asking, and thanks for having me. This
yeah.
is great.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So I thought maybe we could start off by talking a little bit about the sort of improvement, the remarkable improvement in relations between Japan and South Korea. We've talked about it a bit on the show in the past, but largely from the Korea perspective, speaking to other Korea experts about it. We haven't had as much time to delve in on it on the Japan side, so I thought this would be a good opportunity to do this. You know, on the Korean side, clearly, there are a lot of factors at play, including the change of government in South Korea from Moon to Yun that coincided with this turnaround in the relationship. But I'd love to hear, in your opinion, what you think has caused the turnaround in the relationship from a Japanese perspective, and you know, what are the prospects going forward? So great to have you with us.
Great. Thanks again, Victor, for having me. And good to be back.
Sure.
CSIS, can
yeah.
I say?
Yeah. And, place is spruced up a little bit
right,
since you were here.
I know. Yeah. In a different building, too. Yeah. So it's great to be here. So it is a great question. I think what prompted incumbent Prime Minister Kishida to take this step is really kudos to President Yoon. You know, as we know, you know, Prime Minister Kishida was Prime Minister Abe's first foreign minister when Japan and Korea reached an agreement on the so-called comfort women issue. So he personally experienced kind of a pain and agony and frustration while, you know, Moon Jae-in administration, all that he thought, you know, his government was able to accomplish and put this, you know, very unfortunate history behind two countries. And now we can finally look, you know, move forward in a future-oriented agenda. And the change of government happened. And what he thought, you know, two government had built basically, essentially, you know, collapsed. So he was, I think, he was, I believe, a little bit of a skeptic coming in, you know, welcoming President Yoon. But I think what really turned his mind around was President Yoon's decision on the forced labor issue, how he decided to move forward with that issue. It was really an extension of the, you know, basically he reached out a hand to Japan. This is how I'm moving forward because I'm prioritizing better relations with Japan for Korea. So it is a matter of, you know, when he would reciprocate and how. And I think he answered that question by inviting President Yoon to Hiroshima at G7 summit. And also he accompanied President Yoon to pay respect to the memorial of the victims of the Korean residents in Hiroshima who perished at the when the atomic bomb dropped on August 6th. So I think that was the that was also a political decision on his part. There is still a hardcore, you know, conservative who's a very kind of a skeptical view of what may happen after President Yoon leaves. You know, many, you know, there are suspects that talks about how President, you know, Yoon is not exactly popular, you know, in the domestic political context in Korea, whether his decision to move forward would stick beyond his administration. But I think Prime Minister Kishida decided that it is time for Japan also to move closer to Korea. And I think the big backdrop of that is an increasing pressure, geoeconomic, geopolitical pressure from China and ever unpredictable North Korea. So it definitely was an imperative for Japan to look for ways to basically get the Tokyo's relations with Seoul back on track. And it was just a matter of, you know, how they could do it in a reciprocal manner. And I think President Yoon really, you know, took the first step.
Right.
So they took the step back.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that was clear for the Yoon administration as soon as they, even before they took office in the transition, was they were very focused on improving the relationship with Japan. When they sent folks over during the transition to talk about the agenda, the first thing was the United States, but the second thing was Japan. And really ambitious at the time. We thought that's pretty ambitious, what you want to do with Japan, but they've really tried to follow through. You mentioned something, and let me just follow up on sort of the domestic politics of Korea policy in Japan. Mm-hmm. And one thing you mentioned was that the sort of hard right in, I would presume it's in the LDP, the sort of hard right, still uncertain about the future, you know, if Yoon's gone. I think it's certainly a fair concern. But this is not meant to be an indelicate question, but to what extent is the hard right on this particular policy in Japan, have they sort of lost some of their, I don't know what the right word, juice, influence?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, with the tragic passing of former Prime Minister Abe, I'm just trying to understand sort of the politics of the far right on this issue in Japan.
So, you know, politics of Korea policy is kind of a complicated issue because on one hand, you have this far right who's very skeptical about, you know, Korea, like, you know, we've been talking about, you know, what happens after transition. But then those exact same far right people are a staunch advocate of Japan try to resolve North Korea, you know, abductee issue with the North Korea. So in a sense, when, you know, Prime Minister Abe, you know, had that, you know, very tragic, you know, tragically, you know, assassinated. One of the first thought I thought was really Prime Minister Abe really held everybody, those, you know, hard right in line, you know, that he really kept them in line. And that really helped when, because he was a prime minister, I believe back in 2015, when Japan reached an agreement on that so-called comfort woman issue, I think only he was able to accomplish that and basically silence the opposition that, which usually perks up. You and I are both, you know, student of history. So we only have to go back to Prime Minister Murayama's statement on this issue. And because he was a socialist prime minister, we still, you remember how the far right really, hours within that statement came out.
Yeah.
They just barked. And on this one, you know, you know, because Prime Minister Abe was the prime minister, they couldn't say anything. Mm-hmm. And then I think that they see a lot of his policy legacy in terms of, you know, reorienting, you know, toward China, strength, you know, really doubling down on the alliance. And I think his influence is, I think, still very much there in terms of them really not coming out and open in, you know, kind of opposing what Prime Minister Kishida is trying to do. Mm. So that is one interesting aspect of it, I think, which is I have been very surprised, actually, myself, pleasantly surprised at how when Prime Minister Kishida was, you know, doing all this reciprocal gesture toward President Yoon, we really didn't hear much from them. Mm. So.
And what about on Camp David? What was their...
Camp David? You know, Camp David was really well received, in a sense that it really kind of, I think the way it was discussed in Japan was they really anchored Korea in the network of alliances in Indo-Pacific. And again, that was another courageous step that President Yoon took, right? Because, you know, his predecessor was kind of here, kind of there, yeah. But then he always wanted to talk to North Korea. So I think they took that Camp David as basically building a very solid floor in the relationship and have the U.S. involvement in it to make that floor more solid so that, you know, on three capitals, there's much less room to backtrack in any of the very ambitious agenda, but any of the those agenda items that the three leaders agreed upon.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't really follow it as closely as I should have, but you're right. They haven't backtracked, but they're also moving forward, right? And there was at APEC in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I guess the two of them went down to Stanford and did an event with Dr. Rice. Mm-hmm. I think it was on tech, but did you follow that? Like, I don't know.
So that came as a surprise. So yeah. I was kind of blindsided by it. Yeah. So I was like you, I'm like, what they do? What?
Yeah.
But I think that was another thing that, you know, when the Camp David came out, you know, a lot of us talked about what really is missing, you know, moving forward, what really is going to be important is that Japan-Korea bilateral initiatives, not just Trilat. And then I think that really was, to me, that was very symbolic, right, that, you know, that they're willingly doing this now together.
Yeah. So obviously Kishida is very supportive of this. Are there other folks like that you could point to, like politicians who are supportive of sort of the initiatives with Korea? I remember, you know, in the olden days, years ago, there were a whole bunch of both in the Japanese government and in the Japanese political spectrum who were all very pro-Korea. Then we had this really bad period and all of them got Korea fatigue, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's what it was called, right? Korea fatigue.
Korea fatigue, yeah.
And they all were like, even people I've known for years who were very pro-Korea were just like fed up with it. But so is Kishida really sort of leading a change in these views now where people are starting to swing back to being more optimistic about the relationship?
I think so. Yeah. I think more politicians on the LDP side are, I would say, cautiously optimistic. Uh-huh. Again, you know, they're still kind of bitter about, you know, Moon Jae-in period. So they still haven't quite recovered from that yet. So I would say cautiously optimistic. Like, you know, former Defense Minister Onodera, he used to be a very strong proponent of, you know, Japan's relationship with Korea. And he was one of those, you know, people who was kind of disenchanted.
Yeah.
But when he came here to do an event at Stimson in January, that was, you know, one of the first questions to him was, what about Korea? And he said, you know, I'm personally cautiously optimistic with President Yoon. And I think he would only grew more optimistic over time. So if I ask him the same question, he would probably be more optimistic than he was almost a year ago.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, people like former Foreign Minister Taro Kono, who's, you know, a little bit of a heat right now in his current digital minister position. But right. he was also, you know, he has been a member of the Japan, ROK, you know, Japan-Korea, I guess, a parliamentary association for mm-hmm. a long time. Mm-hmm. So I think those people who used to, you know, who used to be like really supportive of those associations, I think they're slowly coming back.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good. Taro Kono is, of course, a Georgetown grad.
But I know, yeah. right.
we hosted him at Georgetown, I remember, just after the pandemic ended. So this is great. So I should say because I assume people who watch this are not just going to be people who watch The Impossible State following CSIS, but people from on the Stimson side who watch this who are interested in Japan on this question of like, how long can this go on? You know, Korea has an election in April, yeah. right? And when I was in Tokyo a couple of months ago, everybody asked about that election. What if the ruling party loses? You know, is Yoon's interest in this relationship with Japan going to dissipate? And I told them that, in my opinion, the answer was absolutely not, because you know, this guy has priority. For better or for worse, he has priorities. He sticks to them. He doesn't really care what the public thinks, right? He sticks to them. And we have to remember that he did all this up until now while his party is in the opposition
right.
in the legislature.
Yeah.
So if after April his party is still in the opposition in the legislature, I don't think that's going to change things. I think he's going to continue to do what he wants to do. And I think as you know, these elections are all about expectations.
Yeah.
And the expectations bar right now is that the ruling party, I mean, that his party won't win.
Right.
So if they lose by less than what was expected, they lose fewer seats,
right.
they gain seats, but they're still in the opposition, mm-hmm. that would all be a victory, right?
Right, so, yeah, absolutely.
So I'm less worried. I mean, and those things I think are important, but the thing that I think really matters is that he believes in it, so he's not going to change, right?
Right.
Regardless of the criticism, he's
not
going to change.
I mean, he sounds like a very kind of, for better or for worse, like you said, very stubborn.
Yeah, he's very stubborn. And you know, he sort of like had his priorities. And what's interesting is there's a direct linear relationship between what they said in the transition,
mm-hmm.
what their plan was in the transition,
right.
and what they're doing now. It's like a linear relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, popularity doesn't seem to get in the way for him, for better or for worse.
Yeah. And, you know, I was very, very surprised in a good way on his speech on that, you know, Liberation Day.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is usually, you know, people in Japan were like, here it comes, you know, we hate Japan speech.
Right, right.
And nothing like that.
Yeah.
And that, I think, caught a lot of people's attention.
Oh, interesting.
And I think that really spoke to, you know, that very solidified, the, you know, people's image in Japan that, oh, you know, so he is really serious.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting. That is interesting. I mean, I know that they were, the Yoon administration was a little bit upset, not at Japan, but that the speech didn't get as much attention in Washington.
Mm.
And I mean, but the problem, of course, it's because it's on August 15th, right? Nobody's in Washington, D.C. on August 15th.
I was vacationing on August 15th.
Everybody's on vacation. Congress is not in session.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the Washington, D.C. is like a ghost town in August.
Yeah.
So that was the reason. It wasn't because it wasn't impactful, as you said. It was really unprecedented.
Yeah. And then, you know, in Japan, you know, August 15th is also huge because that's the day of surrender, right?
Right, right.
So that's usually, you know, with a combination of that and, you know, Korean president do I hate Japan, you know, I hate Japan speech
right.
is like kind of rubbing it in one more time.
Right.
And the fact that it doesn't happen at all. And if anything, you know, all he talked about was how it is important for Korea to move forward with Japan.
Yeah. yeah.
So that really caught a lot of people's attention,
yeah.
including Sankei Shimbun.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing about that speech was it was the first one where I remember a Korean leader publicly acknowledging the role of UN bases in Japan for Korea's defense. Like that had never, they would never acknowledge that.
Yeah.
So that was a big deal. Okay, let's talk a little bit about domestic politics in Japan.
All right.
Because I don't know much about that. And so from a U.S. perspective, obviously, they have, you know, they have a lot invested in both Kishida and Yun.
Absolutely.
When I talk to people in the government, they're always asking, like, how is Yun doing? Like, what? How is he, you know, is he going to be okay? You know, because I think, you know, they want these two leaders to succeed. I read recently that Kishida's popularity is not very high right now, that I saw one headline that said it was at 30 points or something, or
it actually dipped below 30.
Oh, so it's under 30.
And depending on which, you know, which newspaper or, you know, press outlet runs it, it kind of varies from low, like high 20s to like low 30s. Like
right.
There's like variation of it.
Right.
But yeah, median is probably around 30.
So I guess, so a couple of questions. One is, in Korea, we know where there's election. There's election in April, and then there's an election 5 years from when Yun started.
Right.
Right. But in Japan, so like, what do you think? Does this mean we're going to see an election soon? And then what do you think is accounting for the low popularity for Kishida?
So I think what's counting for low popularity for Kishida is like has nothing to do with foreign policy.
Right.
It's more about the just the public's general frustration about inflation. And then at the same time, you know, yen keeps getting weaker, so it just everything is more expensive.
Right.
Right. So that's one thing. And then there's another thing where, you know, they have been trying forever to introduce equivalent of, you know, their equivalent of social security number. They call it my number. Mm-hmm. And how to digitize those system is a huge issue because there are a couple of glitches and, you know, all this like personal information could leak and government has not been quite forthcoming about what kind of, you know, remedies, you know, are done moving forward, or there were a lot of arguments about they should probably even like delay and consider delaying introducing those things. And for example, you know, they try to like digitize, you know, everything, including, you know, healthcare system or pension system. And do you really, you know, Japan is an aging society, and do I really turn to my parents, who's like 78 years old, and not, you know, tell them, you know, they barely can wear, you know, use their smartphone? Do you tell them now to like learn how to, you know, go onto the website and create a portal? And so,
I mean, I have trouble with that.
Me too. And then, you know, forever struggle with like, you know, 12-digit password. And
yeah.
So those issues, I think, people have not been happy with. And then another thing is tax hike. So when Prime Minister Kishida start talking about fundamentally strengthening Japanese defense capability, policy-wise, that has a very broad support. You know, they see China, they see North Korea, and now they see Russia basically, you know, rattling nuclear weapon as an intimidation,
right.
And now they're seeing, you know, Middle East blowing up again. So policy-wise, his idea of increasing defense spending has a support. Mm-hmm. However, usually how to do it is always the issue. And how to pay for it.
Yeah.
And then at this point, you know, now it's a mixture of tax hikes and creating the separate funds, but then basically tax hike, it's never popular on a good day.
Right.
Not exactly when people are already unhappy about, you know, their real wage fee, you know, feels like they're getting, you know, they're making less money because of the inflation and price hike. And so that's even less popular now. And that's the time when, you know, Prime Minister kind of pushed through that thing. So already there are talking about delaying those tax hikes, you know, related to that, that's supposed to fund those increase in the defense spending. But then now that gets U.S. worried because U.S. military planners looks at their defense, you know, their defense acquisition plan. And money comes later, meaning acquisition plan gets pushed back too. So so there's like a whole another alliance related issue that comes with that. But so I think, you know, tax hike, kind of intransparency of those, some of the domestic, you know, structural changes that he's trying to make, general unhappiness about the quality of life there, I think that kind of gets to the kind of a general unhappiness about Prime Minister Kishida. And he's not really the most articulate guy that you meet. So that also doesn't help his, you know, that also doesn't help his cause.
He's not a great communicator.
He's yeah. not a great communicator.
Yeah.
So that that also is not helpful.
So what does that mean then going forward? Does that mean he'll be...
So LDP that is the talk.
To call elections?
So general impression is that Prime Minister Kishida had already missed that snap, calling the election vote.
Right.
Because had he called it in June or something and put all these issues on board, we really need to, someone needs to pay for this defense spending. And Japan's environment is not getting any more safer. So if he called the election sooner and articulate those visions, then that might have been, LDP might still suffer a loss. But then, as we were talking about Korean election, that loss might have been less.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the only reason that he can kind of stay in the government is because oppositions are still in like a disarray. There really is no strong coalition amongst of any of those opposition party that can emerge as a formidable counterproposal to Japanese voters.
Mm-hmm.
So even if his poll is lagging, there really is no reason to actively try to replace him within the LDP party politics either. So he kind of straddled along. However, that said, next spring might be an interesting, like a first quarter of 2024 might be an interesting period to watch, because how much lower his poll number can go before talks begin to speak, start in the within the LDP. Do we really want to fight another election with this guy?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when everybody's kind of looking to what the Vice Prime Minister Aso might think.
Mm-hmm.
Because, he's obviously a veteran politician. He's stuck with Prime Minister Abe too. Now he's, kind of supportive of Prime Minister Kishida. But he has... he's more articulate than yeah. Prime Minister Kishida,
yeah.
right? So he has more of those appeal, direct appeal to the voters. So what he might or might not say could really affect party, psyche within the party. So I will probably watch what Mr. Aso say
uh-huh.
starting around, New Year.
I see. Okay. All right. Very good. That's very interesting. So we will watch for what Mr. Aso says.
Yeah.
He often says interesting things.
Yes.
around New Year's. Okay. You mentioned it earlier, but why don't we go back to it now? And that is the topic of, we talked about it in the context of the far right in mm-hmm. the LDP with regard to abductees in North Korea. So
yeah.
there was a recent statement by Prime Minister Kishida about, I wrote here improving relations with North Korea, but that's not correct. He talked about initiatives to try to establish contact
mm-hmm.
At the leadership level to address the missiles, but also to address this abductions issue.
Yeah.
So I guess one question is, so what's the context of that? Why is he talking about that now? And has anybody really taken up the mantle of this issue since Prime Minister Abe's death, because he was really the champion of this,
mm-hmm.
right, for decades, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much, what made him.
Right, yeah.
As a national level politician.
Yeah.
So the short answer is no one comes close, with his, including gravitas, influence,
uh-huh.
That... late former Prime Minister Abe can't offer to this issue.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't think of anyone. However, that said, I think Prime Minister Abe also, when he was in the office, toward the end of his tenure, tried that you know, when President Trump met with Kim Jong-un, there's a whole, you know, flurry of shuttle, you know, summit-level diplomacy, and Japan kind of was an odd man out. And Japan still is an odd man out in terms of, you know, leader of Japan is really kind of the only leader in that region that has not established that leadership-level contact with North Korea. So I think Prime Minister Kishida really is keen on giving another try to that. Primary reason is, you know, like you said, there's definitely missile, but then also, you know, for Japan, abduction is one of those issues that you can never say it's done because there's still, you know, there's still unaccounted abductees, and the family of the abductees are, you know, really aging. You know, we already lost a couple of very senior notable family members, right? So there is a sense of urgency on the Prime Minister Kishida's part that at least he, you know, he needs to try to establish that leadership level communication with North Korea so that, you know, the abductees' families can see that, you know, their government is trying to do something. Even though in a realistic sense, to get the full account of those who are still accounted for is probably near impossible at this point. But, you know, family needs to feel that their government is trying on their behalf.
Is doing something, yeah. Are there no other politicians? Because like you said, this is an issue that resonates with the Japanese public, right? I mean, this is something that really gets, I don't know what that, but it really just seems to resonate with the Japanese, and it continues even after Prime Minister Abe is gone. I mean, there are no other politicians that have sort of, you've seen sort of gravitating towards this cause or, you know, meeting with the families or taking pictures with them or things like that.
Yeah, so. I really don't see many. That's an interesting point because you would think that that is a humanitarian issue that, you know,
it's
any
a human rights issue.
Yeah, human rights issue. Humanitarian issue. And it's, you know, looking back, it's, you know, public safety issue too, right? Anti-terrorism issue. So now that you mention it, I think you're right. I mean, it's surprising that no one else is actually actively trying to pick up the banner. You know, everybody has that, you know, blue ribbon.
The blue flat ribbon.
But, you know, no one has done what Prime Minister Abe has done. You know, he always talked about the issue. He always, you know, made time for the families. And so That's interesting. I wonder why that is myself. Part of it is there is kind of an unfortunate side story of that where families are families, right? They are truly suffering. But there are people around families who try to politicize the issue. And that may be why some of the politicians may be hesitant to get in there, because they might not just be want to be associated with those, some of the, and, you know, those, you know, self-named supporter of the families.
Right. I see. Okay. Last question, as we're near the end of time here, is on China. The foreign ministers of Japan, South Korea, and China recently met to set up the trilateral summit meeting. All right, as you know, we have not seen this since pre-pandemic, right, 2019. So I guess two questions here. Why, at least from a Japan perspective, like, why is China interested in doing this now? And then what are Japan's expectations? And how really is Kishida trying to position Japan in terms of China policy, though?
So that's an interesting question. So I think from Japanese perspective, China is all of a sudden, you know, start to do this again, because I think China really feels pressure now.
Yeah.
You know, and then now with keys, again, Korea, you know, with President Yoon basically anchoring Korea much more deeply into the alliance with U.S., partnership Japan, you know, definitely pressure comes from there. So that definitely incentivized China. For Japan's perspective, also economically, China still is a huge neighbor that has a very, very big trade volume with Japan. And even if we are going into the era of, you know, friendshoring, de-risking, complete decoupling is not a not a realistic option for any countries, and that certainly includes Japan mm-hmm. and Korea. So definitely the interest would be for Japan to use that Japan-China-Korea trilateral fora to look for ways to engage with China somehow. Security side is kind of, you know, the lost cause almost. However, they do need to have some level of communication with China, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of de-risking. And I think that fora is good for Japan, because with the President Yoon kind of solidly on more closer to Japan, you know, that's not a forum where China could now easily say to Korea and say, hey, we're both victims of Japan.
Let's gang up
right.
on Japan, yeah.
So
yeah.
I think there's a greater level of comfort uh-huh. and for Japan to get back involved with that.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine that it will go forward, right? I mean, I think they've committed to it, but even yeah. now, especially after APEC in San Francisco and the U.S.-China bilateral mm-hmm. meeting, that I imagine that China would be very happy to go forward with this. I find these things never produce anything tangible, right? They don't produce anything. It's a lot of ceremony and things,
right.
but I agree with you. I think China's feeling a lot of pressure, not just only the poor performance of its economy, but investment flows leaving the country,
yeah.
a lot of U.S. No. money leaving the country, and then all the administration's success mm-hmm. with Camp David, AUKUS, Quad, all these
right.
things.
I think so.
Yeah.
They're just under a lot of pressure.
So this was great. Yuki, thank you so much for joining us. We will, I know there's a lot of folks who look at it from the Japan side and like they're worried about like Korean domestic politics, can Yoon survive and all this. But I have less concern about that. I think he's gonna go forward no matter what. And to me, the real question is like Japan because Kishida took a big step, right?
Yeah.
Really stuck his neck out mm-hmm. on doing this, counting on Korea to sort of live up to what they say.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, it's important for him to survive too, right?
Yeah.
For him to be able to continue with the policy as mm-hmm. well. So.
And then I think that's what makes Camp David really important, because even those, you know, suspects have to say, okay, U.S. is now involved. So it is more of it is not just Japan are okay, right? It's, you know, U.S. is committed to this relationship.
Yeah.
And you know, that is like the most visible demonstration from coming out of Washington that they are interested in making sure that Japan and Korea stays on track.
I think that's what made it. When I talk to White House folks about this, all they do is give credit to Yoon and Kishida. All they do is say, like, you know, both of these leaders really sort of went out on a limb here. And so they give all the credit to Yoon and Kishida. But I think you're right. The U.S. Direct involvement, the use of the venue of Camp David, mm-hmm. historic place, really was also the U.S. sort of sticking their neck out and saying, we really want this to succeed this time. So.
And then I think that's what matters, I think, for both domestic audience in Japan and Korea to see that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And they won an award, right? They won, Yoon and Kishida won the John F. Kennedy Profiles in Courage
Award. Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, that was a nice external validation of what they're doing, so. To convince the skeptical publics
right.
in both countries. So,
mm-hmm.
so. Anyway, again, Yuki, thank you so much for joining us. Yuki Tatsumi from the Stimson Center. And thank you to all our listeners and viewers for watching another episode of The Impossible State. I think we're going to try to get one more in before the holidays in December. So until then, we'll see you on the next episode.
If you have a question for one of our experts about the impossible state, email us at impossiblestate@csis.org. If you want to dive deeper into the issues surrounding North Korea, check out Beyond Parallel. That's our micro website that's dedicated to bringing a better understanding of the Korean Peninsula. You can find it at beyondparallel.org. www.csis.org. And don't forget to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. That's so more listeners can find us. It's very helpful. We're now also streaming on Spotify, so you can find us there too, where you find all your music. How cool is that? And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This is The Impossible State.